And we're off with an interview with Flight Lieutenant Phil Waterman of the Royal Canadian Air Force. The date is the 18th of August, 1986, and my name is Rick Aylward. First of all, Mr. Waterman, just a little bit of background information on yourself, if you could. First of all, where and when you were born?
Born December the 25th, 1918. In the town of Kuroshu, Alberta.
Okay. And first of all, this is a question I ask quite often for these interviews, is did you have, what background did you or your family have in the military prior to wartime service?
Nil.
Okay. How about family relations? Father, brother, sister? Any affiliation with the military from those points of view?
Prior to the war or
prior to going into?
No.
None whatsoever?
None whatsoever.
Okay, and you're one of the few people I've interviewed with the RCAF who actually flew fighters, which we're going to get into a little bit later on. But I'm wondering, what attracted you initially to the RCAF? Why the air wing rather than, we'll say, Navy or Army?
Clean sheets and good food.
Okay.
And I really wasn't too keen on packing a rifle and foot slogging.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't what I really cared for.
Wasn't in the cards.
Wasn't in the cards, no.
Was it anything to do with the romantic attachment to flying itself, anything along those lines?
Not at all, no.
Mm-hmm. You joined up in 1939, and I'm just wondering...
No, 1940.
1940, sorry. I'm wondering, particularly in view of today's stringent requirements for pilots and whatnot, what sort of requirements were the RCAF looking for in those days?
Minimum requirements was senior matriculation as to your academic standing and passing quite a rigid medical.
Mm-hmm. As we just established, you did join in 1940, not in 1939. Originally, you were shipped to Brandon, Manitoba, I assume to be fitted out for uniforms and
that's correct.
Shots, a series of shots and whatnot. In January 1941, you went to Calgary for 5 weeks for guard duty. What did that entail?
Guard duty was guarding supposedly guarding an airport.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Pounding the beat around the perimeter of the airport, particularly during the night.
Was that something that was peculiar to your class, or
no?
Was that something?
This was national.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So all pilots at some time or another underwent that sort of.
All air crews, regardless of what station, whether they were in Vancouver or in Prince Albert or in Toronto or mm-hmm. wherever there were airfields or airports.
Okay. In the spring of 1941, you ultimately go to Regina, Saskatchewan, to the initial flight training school, ground school. I'm wondering if you could expand on this. First of all, I guess basically, how would they determine if you're a good candidate for flight?
Well, they had what they called a link trainer as a piece of equipment. Really wasn't much of a piece of equipment to determine whether you're going to be a pilot or not, but it gave them some clues whether you could do the rudiments of flying.
Mm-hmm.
And this was their way of determining whether you're going to be a pilot or not.
So it was their way of weeding out.
Weeding out.
Yeah, yeah. And if it was determined you wouldn't be a good pilot, then what navigation, I guess, would be?
They'd send you out generally as an observer at that time,
mm-hmm.
Or if you wished, as a wireless operator, gunner,
mm-hmm.
or a straight air gunner.
Mm-hmm. And since, as we'll discuss later on, you were obviously a pilot, I presume you did relatively well in Regina.
Average.
In April 1941, you wind up in Vancouver from Regina. I'm wondering how you got there to the flight school in Vancouver.
Well, there was various stations required a group of students to fill a class that they required. And we were fortunate enough to get out to come to the coast.
Mm-hmm. What types of aircraft would you be training on at this time?
We were on Tiger Moths.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In Vancouver, I presume, aside from flight training, you would be getting I guess the equivalent of naval silhouette recognition, German aircraft silhouette recognition.
It was part of the ground school training.
Mm-hmm. Aircraft recognition
and naval recognition.
Mm-hmm. Would they be covering such things as, aside from silhouette recognition, would they be covering such things as supposed capabilities of German planes?
Yes,
mm-hmm.
Totally.
Mm-hmm. Ultimately, you wind up, I guess, as most air crew would, as they're progressing through their training in elementary flying school. Could you explain a little bit about this? What was that?
Well, at that time, we were required to take a minimum of 10 hours dual instruction prior to making our solo flights.
Mm-hmm.
Subsequent to the solo flights, we had an additional 20 hours of dual instruction, all told about 60 hours of mm-hmm. flying, and that concluded our elementary flying.
Mm-hmm. And given the fact that, as you say, there were really no family connections with the military prior to wartime service, I'm wondering at this point, how did you adapt to military training and discipline, military life in general?
Me personally?
You personally.
Hated discipline. I was a bit of a renegade.
Mm-hmm. You after the elementary flying school, you go to the service flying school where you get your wings, so to speak. What do you do to qualify for your wings? I imagine a certain number of hours flown would be one.
Yeah, sorry. We completed 130 or 140 hours of flying. Then we got our wings.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And no doubt a celebration to go along with it afterward.
No question.
In June 1941, you are posted to Claire's Home, Alberta, fighter school, in effect. And since you are the first and only veteran that I've interviewed who was posted to a fighter squadron, I'm just wondering, what was the attraction for you of fighters as opposed to bombers?
Well, when we completed our elementary flying in Vancouver, as a class is completed at a service flying school,
mm-hmm.
they require a new class of students. Now, there were two schools that required a class. One was in Calgary, and they flew twin-engine Hansens. And if you were sent to a twin-engine school, you ultimately wound up on bombers. And the other class, other school, was Claire's Home, and they had single-engine Harvards. And on conclusion of getting your wings at a Harvard school, normally you would go out ultimately flying fighters such as Spitfires or Hurricanes
mm-hmm.
that were available in Great Britain at that time.
Right.
Apparently at that time we had a choice to either go to Calgary or Claire's Home. We had a quick vote, and the consensus was that Claire's Home was the choice.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, on arrival to the metropolis of Claire's Home, we found that the school hadn't been complete. The buildings were all finished and the runways were all complete, but no airplanes. So we spent the first 3 weeks of our time doing ground school as much as possible, and that
right.
was some navigation, meteorology, whatever came with the ground school on the course. After 3 weeks, 5 o'clock one morning, we heard aircraft overhead. Everybody jumped out of bed.
You thought fighters.
Great, here come the Harvards. Unfortunately, in came 16 of the most broken down Hansons we ever laid our eyes on. From then on, I was a basket case. Determined to go on to fighters, and here I wind up with twin engine Hansons, which ultimately was supposed to lead to bombers.
Bombers. What would be the reason for that? Would that be just simply that the wartime production hadn't geared up enough for better planes, or the RCAF couldn't get their hands on them?
Oh, just a screw up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I was kind of curious too. Who was training the potential pilots? Was this RAF personnel or RCAF? Or a little bit of both.
No, in our elementary school, there were all civilian pilots. Most of them were American instructors. The instructors at Claire's home were trained instructors, mostly Canadians.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if the Commonwealth Air Training Program had got underway by this point.
Oh, it had gone underway, you know. Mm-hmm. Not in the large, massive way that it ultimately became, mm-hmm. but a good many schools were open, and pilots that completed their wings, if they wanted to become instructors, went to what they called a central flying school and got their instructor's rating, mm-hmm. and back to various schools, mm-hmm. as instructors.
Well, I take it at this time then there weren't any Aussies or New Zealanders or...
As instructors?
Yeah.
No.
On the 15th of August, 1941, you graduated with your wings from Claire's home. And I understand at this time you were a bit of a renegade as far as, I guess, attitude and whatnot. I'm just wondering what you meant by that when you were talking about that earlier.
Well, a third of the class, the upper echelon, automatically got commissions. The other two-thirds graduated as sergeant pilots.
Mm-hmm.
And I was in the lower echelon. I think... namely because of my attitude.
Mm-hmm. Being non-military oriented, I guess it was...
Not so much that. Very discouraged due to the fact that we were on Hansons, mm-hmm. being mm-hmm. twin engines.
How about your fellow pilots? Was their attitude similar in that respect as far as disappointment goes?
It never occurred to me how they really felt. Mm-hmm. I know a few of them were very disappointed.
Mm-hmm. So this was strictly a personal whim.
Just my own personal choice.
In late August 1941, you returned to Vancouver on furlough.
Correct.
And then ultimately you ship out to Halifax, Nova Scotia, on your way overseas. As a by now trained airman, what were your impressions of the voyage on the way to Europe? I understand there were some difficulties with your form of transportation.
We were slated to go overseas on one of the Empress ships owned by the CPR. It was the Empress of Asia. It had apparently picked up a load of Italian prisoners in Africa, transported to the city of New York, then up to Halifax, and we boarded this Empress of Asia, but it
perhaps not too aptly named.
No, it was absolutely filthy. It was just crawling with lice and cockroaches and vermin. The whole shipload of passengers disembarked. Back we went to the barracks. Subsequently, they sent one of the senior medical officers from Ottawa to inspect the ship, and they kept us in barracks for probably about a week, as I can remember, hoping to clean up the ship. So we back on the same piece of junk, and the job was absolutely inadequate. Thus, a couple of hundred airmen disembarked via the gangplank and
Springer lines
and lines. Yeah, they're riding down these ropes. That 200 or so that got off the boat subsequently were taken overseas on the Louis Pasteur, which was a French luxury liner, and they passed us midway on the Atlantic, completely unescorted, because they didn't require any military, any naval escort at all.
I guess they would have got the speed.
Probably 30 knots on their own, which was, they couldn't be touched really by U-boats.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What about the Empress of Asia? I imagine you would be in convoy.
We had a huge convoy. We had 148, 150 ships in our convoy. And that was the first convoy that we were escorted by American naval vessels. They escorted us halfway across the Atlantic.
Mm-hmm. Presumably to be picked up by the Royal Navy.
Royal Navy.
Yeah, right. Okay.
It was a 14-day voyage from Halifax to Liverpool.
Mm-hmm. In September, therefore, using that mathematical calculation, you arrived, as you say, in Liverpool. And I'm wondering, what were your impressions, although your training in Canada was preparing you for war, you actually, well, by the time you get to England, you're in a theater of war. And I'm wondering, what were your impressions of wartime England and your reception by the British officials?
When we arrived in Liverpool, a group captain in the Royal Air Force came on board, and we expected a formal greeting, but he was rather nasty. He said, now that you're on English soil and under the jurisdiction of the Royal Air Force, we won't tolerate any nonsense from the colonials. That didn't go over too well with the Canadians, certainly not with the New Zealanders and Australians who were also on board the Empress of Asia.
Do you suppose that it occurred to the English that by using terms like colonial, that they were not exactly endearing themselves, or did it really matter? I guess it's for
them. That was their interpretation, that we were truly colonials, and they treated us like they treated the Indians or any of their other colonies.
Mm-hmm. How about your reception by British fighting men themselves, below the officer?
100%.
Mm-hmm. From Liverpool, you go by train to the south of England, where I believe you're then posted to an OTU.
Correct.
Operational Training Unit, which in effect, I guess, was an advanced fighter bomber base. I was just wondering, how would your training here differ from that received in Canada, or would it be just a more extensive version?
It was a more extensive version of the of our service flying school.
Mm-hmm.
Operational training units, that's quite right. It was just another 4 or 5 weeks of intensive training prior to going or being posted onto squadrons.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. As you say, it was it could range anywhere from 4 to 6 weeks, I guess.
4 to 6 weeks.
Training.
Right.
And then the usual route was to be posted to a squadron. However, you weren't.
No, I was posted out to a OTU up in Scotland on Whitley's,
mm-hmm.
which from there I guess you'd be posted on to Halifax's, or I don't know, I can't remember if they had four engine bombers then, or Stirlings.
Wellington's,
yes.
Yeah.
But I elected to disregard my posting.
What would be the usual penalty for such an action?
It didn't occur to me. I just sat in at the reception center in Bournemouth.
By yourself?
By myself. The rest of the class, of our graduating class, were all posted out to various OTUs. And I just sat in Bournemouth.
I guess it boiled down, amongst other things, the fact you didn't want to go to Scotland for...
No, it wasn't a question of Scotland. I resented being posted out onto bombers.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
2 weeks had gone by, and our junior class from Claire's home had arrived.
Who were behind you?
Who were behind us.
Right.
They questioned what I was doing in Bournemouth. I said, well, I hang around here for a while. I wasn't too keen on going to any OTUs. Ultimately, would wind me up on bombers. Anyway, must have been a month or so had gone by, and I got an unfriendly visit from one of the senior officers from London.
RAF?
No, he was
RCAF.
And he questioned me on my what I was sitting on my ass doing nothing. Anyway, I told him my sad story, and he said that he thought he'd send me back to Canada as a staff pilot.
Which, as you said earlier, is not exactly a glamorous...
To the contrary. You'd be towing drogues or flying... navigation students around the country.
Mm-hmm.
And that didn't go down too well. But in any case, a couple of weeks went by, and I was posted to a staff pilot school up in North Wales.
What exactly did you do there?
Towing
drugs.
I towed drugs. And the bonus really was 300 or 400 additional flying hours, which didn't do me any harm.
No, ultimately, I guess.
Ultimately, it didn't do me any harm.
And you were there for something like six months.
Six months. And in the meantime, I got my commission.
And there's a little story behind that, I believe.
Oh, yeah, I put in my 6 months, and they wanted to send me to a satellite station that had Ansons and to fly students around. So that was the end of my tenure. I said, forget it. I put in my time as a Stooge pilot, and I thought it would be just time for me to go out on a... get out on a fighter OTU,
mm-hmm.
which they consented to.
Which they did, in fact, consent to, as you say. In May 1942, you wind up at a Spitfire OTU for a period of approximately a month in Scotland.
In Scotland.
And ultimately, you were posted to RAF Squadron Cornwall.
Yeah, 65 Squadron.
65 Squadron. And I'm wondering here, how did you get along with the RAF people, who I'm sure, at least the officers at least, must have been aware of your background to an extent.
They were aware of my history.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And how were you treated by them?
Oh, very well.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
You weren't considered to be that renegade colonial?
No, not at all. As a matter of fact, it was quite a mixed squadron. We had two Canadians, we had an American, we had two New Zealanders, we had two or three Australians.
Mm-hmm.
We had a Frenchman from the Free French Air Force, Irish, Welsh. We had quite a mixed squadron of personnel. Mm-hmm. We all got along very well.
Mm-hmm. Well, based at Cornwall, you were involved in conducting shore patrols.
Mm-hmm.
And wondering if you could just expand a little bit on what that... Obviously, it sounds like you were patrolling offshore.
That's basically what it was.
Mm-hmm.
Cornwall being the far end of the west southwest coast of Great Britain.
What would would you be, if anything, what would you be expecting to encounter there as far as Germany was concerned?
Very little.
Mm-hmm.
Very little. That was part of the job. Went with the territory of being that far south and west.
Mm-hmm.
That we really only did shore patrols
mm-hmm.
up and down the coast as far as we could go.
Could almost be considered an extension of training.
Well, it was apparently it was a rest period for the squadron who had just moved from the south coast,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
not far from London.
Right.
And they had been there apparently about 6 months, so this was sort of a rest period for them.
You said in the preliminary interview that you had a strange experience here while based at Cornwall.
Yeah, the second or third day arriving, having arrived at the squadron, I went up on a shore patrol with one of the pilots. Flying up and down the coast, which was on a beautiful day, and flying line abreast, looking at my fellow airman, for no apparent reason, he made a big, long, looping turn. I couldn't quite get what he was doing, and all of a sudden he just rolled over on his back and straight into the water. The only thing I could suggest at that time is he must have had a heart attack.
Mm-hmm. Heart attack or stroke or
stroke.
From Cornwall, by the middle of 1942 approximately, you go to Gravesend, which
Gravesend,
is,
yeah.
Gravesend, near London, I guess just to the south.
Yeah, it's right on the Thames.
Right. And at this point, you are on active duty with the Spitfire Squadron.
Yeah.
And for the next year and a half or so, until January 1944, you're on active operations.
Yeah.
I understand mainly escorting American Air Force daylight bombing raids and whatnot over to the continent. And I'm just wondering, during that period of the year and a half or so, you read that the Spitfire was a wonderful machine to fly and whatnot.
It was a superb piece of equipment.
Mm-hmm.
They had various marks of Spitfires. One that would be superior in their quality up to 15,000 feet.
Mm-hmm.
The ones that we were flying, we were best, our best operational height was 35,000, anywhere between 30 and 35,000.
And ultimately, when we come to cover what happens to you being shot down, that those two models ultimately have a bearing on what happened to you.
Oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. What about, as we said, you're basically escorting U.S. Air Force daylight bombing raids.
Yeah. We were high cover.
Mm-hmm. What about, what would be the main threat at this point in the daylight, would be flak or German fighters?
Fighters.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which were really far and few between, because right after the summer of 1941, because of Germany declaring war on Russia, they took many, many of their squadrons of fighters to look after the East Front.
Mm-hmm.
North Africa took a number of their fighter squadrons, and sparingly there weren't too many on the West Front, which
comparatively speaking, mm-hmm.
because we in 150 trips that I made over Europe, or basically Holland and France and Belgium, rarely did we see any fighters. Rarely.
Mm-hmm. As we alluded to a few moments ago, this relatively uneventful period lasted roughly for a year and a half until January 44, when all that changed. You were shot down at this time, presumably over Germany, and I'm just wondering if you could relate the circumstances surrounding
that event?
While we were in Cornwall, we had the fighters that we were on then were most efficient up to 15,000 feet.
Mm-hmm.
And an American that was on the squadron at the time, the two of us thought we'd like to go into two or three airfields in and around Brest Harbor. And we put in for a trip, waiting for the right kind of weather, looking for low-lying cloud, probably rain,
mm-hmm.
and which never came to pass. Now, a year and a half later, January the 1st of 44, all of a sudden a signal came through authorizing this trip. Well, we changed airfields, we changed our whole geography, had changed, and we changed aircraft. The airplanes that we flew were really not suitable for low flying.
Low flying.
No.
And that ultimately is the crucial point for you.
Probably was.
Yeah.
Probably was. In any case, the American who I chose to do this trip 18 months prior, he happened to be on leave, and I just piped up and asked if anybody's interested in going on this fast little trip. And one of our English pilots volunteered. We went over to the intelligence officer's office, and he laid out a trip for us, and away we went. Now, unfortunately, I was wearing civilian clothes, because prior to, on return of the trip, I was to catch a train to London on leave, and I always wore civilian clothes when I went on leave. I had a nice pair of brown brogues, brown gabardine slacks, white shirt, but I did have a battle jacket on. And no dog tags. Now, away we went, crossing the English Channel, 50 feet above the water, so we couldn't be detected by their radar.
How efficient was their radar?